The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This summer, enjoy boating, biking, and hiking in Ottawa's fresh outdoor spaces. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's July 10th, 2024 at 2:37 in the afternoon. Hello. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. I'm John Williams. We'll broadcast portions of this Saturday night on WGN Radio. If you're driving around and you miss us, there we are Saturday nights on WGN, and you can hear me weekdays on GN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, a former Chicago reporter and columnist, now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago and WCIU, and contributor to many other places.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency trying to change the world. You can also check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
How to change the world, man.
I'm writing that down.
I'm just trying to get out my newsletter. I'm Eric Zorn, the depressed and furious publisher of the Picayune Sentinel Substack newsletter.
We'll get to that in just a minute. Is that the slogan or logo for your other marketing business, trying to change the world?
Our vision is a world without limits on human potential. Wow. So the way we do that is by changing laws. And we've been around 6 years, and I don't talk about it much on the podcast. And I was like, why not? I should mention it that we've changed over 70, helped change over 70 laws around the country. We employ about 28 people full time. So I spend a lot of time on that.
But they're all like library fine laws, right?
All like minor traffic, mostly traffic violations. Yeah.
Curb heights and so on.
What's an example?
Seriously. What are we talking about here? What kind of laws?
A bunch. Well, we worked on legalizing medical marijuana in Mississippi, which you could try to say five times fast. We've worked since Iron Light was started. There's been 11 states that have passed universal school choice, and we've worked in seven of those, I believe. Working a lot in energy and actually in solar energy right now. There's a lot of red states where you can't do solar energy because it's politically polarizing. But it's good because we should have it both for environmental reasons and it's better for the grid. There's better competition. So we work on all sorts of different stuff.
Does it have a bias? Would I say these are generally conservative causes?
I think we are definitely biased. I'm speaking to you now from Las Vegas, where I'm at Freedom Fest. So there's a lot of crazy conservatives here, but there's also good libertarian people who I like. When we say limits on human potential, it's usually people trying to use the force of government to stop their competition, to stop someone from living out their full potential. So we're very sort of free market libertarian oriented in the work we decide to do.
To get involved in social causes like the abortion legislations across the country.
No.
Donald Trump said it's going to be up to the states. Will you take up that cause?
We don't do social issues for the most part. Abortion's one where, I mean, even in the libertarian space, there's a lot of differentiating views. I would describe myself as pro-choice, but there's a lot of fair-minded people on both sides of that, and it's just not an issue that we work on.
Not to totally derail this podcast to talk about Austin's business, but what do you make of the recent Supreme Court decision about Chevron deference and the ability or lack thereof of federal agencies to make laws?
One of my friends described it as the libertarian Super Bowl that was overturned, and I would tend to agree. I think it's, of course, there's uncertainty about how that's going to be, what the near-term effects of that will be. But I think it's great that we could have a legislative branch that's focused on writing great legislation and an executive branch that's focusing on carrying out laws rather than a very large administrative body that is sort of writing laws as they go. It's really, really great for American ingenuity and business, too, I think. I know people personally who have had very innovative businesses, especially in digital businesses in the last few years, never able to get clarity from the federal government about the legality of what they're doing until they're sued for every single penny that they're worth and their business is destroyed. And a lot of that is due to the powers that were invested in those agencies because of Chevron deference. So I think it's a great win.
But the problem with that, right, Austin, is that the people who know most about that are, in fact, the people in those agencies. Members of Congress rotating through every 2 years aren't expert on these things and are more susceptible to lobbyists or just the whims of the day. Chevron deference, I've only recently looked into, but it sure seems to me like I have more faith in the unknown administrators than I do the members of Congress.
Right. But the issue being that the unknown administrative members are not duly elected officials. Those are not people who have accountability to the general public. So I'm not saying by any means that politicians are smarter than career bureaucrats in a given field, by no means. And I don't think that will ever be true. But it's a question of separation of powers and deliberative democracy. And I think this decision moves us in the right direction on both of those things.
All right. Well, I'll get back to you when they make when the Congress makes some harebrained decision. And I'm going to point my finger at you and you'll have to defend. Well, let's start this week with the big national story. But let's not spend too much time on it. After all, each day that passes with Joe Biden still at the top of the Democratic ticket makes it less likely that he will vacate his candidacy or release his delegates to the floor in an open election at the DNC in Chicago this summer. It is what it is. He's running and has even challenged others in his own party to take him on. Morning Joe, he said, run against me, challenge me at the convention. And perhaps the party and its allies are doing themselves no favors writing and talking and fulminating about this. I think the policies, this is just me personally, are more important than the man. And many of the Biden policies are popular and effective. So give it up, Eric. When you complained about protests over Gaza, for instance, you reminded us that this upcoming election is a binary decision, you kept saying. You only get to pick one. So the question we will now start with is, are Democrats their own worst enemy right now by continuing to call for Joe Biden to step aside? Eric, you go first.
Well, I will field this question first. I think that the Democratic Party right now is riven between two factions. The one I belong to says, look, Joe Biden is not qualified to run for president for the next 4 years. He's mentally diminished. He clearly doesn't have the physical or mental abilities to make it another 4.5 years. He may be able to make it through this campaign, but he is diminished enough. In March of 2020, he said he was going to be a bridge to the future, and now he seems to want to be a bridge to his own glory or something, that he needs to step aside and let the next generation take field, because this election is too consequential to send a weakened leader into leading the battle. And then there's the other faction of the Democratic Party largely agrees, I think, with what I'm saying in terms of his fitness. But they say, look, arguing about this, talking about it, distracts from mm-hmm. how comprehensively terrible Donald Trump is. And it makes it more likely that he's going to lose, because the voters are not going to be enthusiastic or inspired, that we need to pretend that all of this terrible debate performance and this excruciating interview with George Stephanopoulos never happened. And we need to start talking about, the Project 2025 and all the other things that the Trump victory would bring, and just kind of carry on as though he's fine, and tell people that he's fine. It's going to be fine. And the party is really split by that. I mean, I have good friends who are really angry at me over this and about my point of view, but the party's in trouble, and I think that it's not too late. I'm hoping that it's not too late for the party, the party leaders, the donors, everyone to talk Biden off the ledge and say, look, man, you've had 4 great years. You'll go down in history as one of the best presidents, really probably in the top 10 presidents of all time, if you step aside now. And if you don't, and you lose to Donald Trump because of your own ego, then you'll go down as an infamous character.
It's been very disorienting the last week, especially because you see folks like an Ezra Klein at the New York Times and like a James Carville storming the Bastille and saying, we got to get this guy out, we need a new process. And then you have your AOCs, your Ilhan Omars, Brandon Johnsons all saying, this is our guy, this is the nominee.
J.B. Pritzker.
Pritzker, we look forward to, coronating him in Chicago. And I really don't see, I think if I had to choose between one path or the other on what is more likely to win, the unknown future without a Joe Biden at the top is more likely to result in Donald Trump not becoming president. So getting him out definitely moves the ball forward in that direction. I just, at this late stage in the game, I still don't see a path to that happening. You also see people like a Nancy Pelosi saying things like, you know, he's going to have to decide. I believe that was what she said today. And the New York Times reported that, again, in sharp contrast to things J.B. Pritzker and Brandon Johnson are saying, which is that the decision is made. He's in. Biden has made the decision. He said he's in. So I really think that Democrats, by sticking with Biden this long, kind of themselves on this, because it's very, very late. The headlines coming out of this are going to be, if you change horses, it will be the disarray and the drama behind that. I don't know if it will necessarily even be energizing, but sticking with Biden throughout the rest of the campaign, there will be a microscope on every single move. And if he has another episode like he did in the debate, or even some things he was saying in his speeches, like saying he was going to beat Trump in 2020, that's going to be a new media crisis every day. And he's losing these swing states now. And not only is he losing swing states, you're seeing states like Minnesota, Virginia, New Mexico go from lean to secure Democrat states to being toss-ups or lean right. So
yeah, New York as well.
You can't really overstate the shift that's happened here. But I don't think Democrats have a way out of this. My guess as of today is that Biden stays in.
I think he will still drop out. I think the fact that you still have Nancy Pelosi making those comments just yesterday while he was having his phone call with the mayors, for instance, and after he had already sent his rather bullying letter, I think, to all of Congress saying that he's staying in, you still have her saying there's still time to do this. She specifically said that there is still time to talk about this. We need to talk about it after he gets back from NATO, and then the president needs to make his decision. Now, today she's denying that that means that she wants him to drop out. But since he's already said his decision is to stay in, if you're saying that he still needs to make a decision, then you want him to rethink that. She just didn't want it reported quite that vehemently, because she knows, as I'm sure everyone knows who knows him, that he's just getting his the hair up on his back even more when people say that to
him. He's got his stubborn on right now, doesn't he?
Right. There's no doubt in my mind. He can and probably still will. You know, just yesterday, another senator stood up, Senator Bennett from Colorado, stood up and unequivocally said he needs to step down. And Senator Patty Murray is still being put in the just questioning category. But again, if you read her statement, these people who are said to be just questioning, they're really saying he needs to drop out, and they're being diplomatic about it.
Be interesting to see what that new ticket would look like then. We talked about that last week. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. But Brandon, where's your head today?
Well, you can also add Senator Richard Blumenthal to that growing coal. I've been on the it's got to be someone other than Biden train for a while, even before the debate performance. I think the debate was set up intentionally early to allow space for something like this to happen, because Democrats knew there may be a situation we may have to switch out. Joe Biden has said repeatedly, watch me, watch me. And we watched, and it went terribly. So at this rate, I think the best course of action, I've seen way more evidence to support a different candidate, would be more optimal to defeating Donald Trump at this rate. I think it has to be Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris would have a strong shot. She's a prosecutor running against a convicted felon. I think that is quite a setup in a law and order matchup. She can make the case. At this point, the baseline is really low. The Democrats need someone to communicate the stakes of this election, and Joe Biden has trouble communicating. They need someone to communicate on abortion, and Joe Biden has trouble communicating on abortion. Like, these are critical things that the Democrats need to be able to win, take over the House, the Senate, and the White House, and Joe Biden can't really make it happen. So I think Kamala Harris is your best option at the top. Who's the second? It's got to be a white guy. And I think that's a winning ticket.
Could Barack Obama pull him aside and just, you know, like close the doors? No, you're laughing. I think I'm like, who could get in his ear? Clearly his wife's not helping out. George Clooney hasn't helped out. If Barack Obama just sat him down and said some of the stuff you said or whatever.
I don't know if Barack Obama helps, because from what I've heard and stuff I've heard on background, you know, outwardly, Barack and Biden are buddy-buddy. Privately, Biden has a little resentment toward Barack Obama for not endorsing him early in the 2020 primaries, for staying kind of out of it. I do think, though, today, Hakeem Jeffries, the Speaker of the House, is the House Minority Leader. He is going to be meeting with Joe Biden and relaying the concerns he's been hearing from House members. Joe Biden does have much respect for Hakeem Jeffries.
Yeah.
He also respects Nancy Pelosi. If either one of those people say, hey, man, let it go, I think he starts to really start to listen. But this streak he's on, it's very Trumpy. I'm the only one that can defeat Donald Trump. I'm the only candidate. It's got to be me.
Only God can tell me what to do. Yeah.
Only God. Like, it's like, bro, like this is even your ego.
Did I miss that?
Stephanopoulos.
In the interview.
He's even bragging about his crowd sizes. It's very Trumpy. What Biden's going through. I would disagree a little bit with Austin saying that it's too late. I think we are in a unique environment right now, unique political situation, where if the Democrats were to put somebody forward, and I agree with Brandon that it probably has to be Kamala Harris, and I also agree that I think she's going to be a stronger candidate than a lot of people think. There is a lot of time to get a message out in this media environment when there's this much attention focused on this election, a lot of time to gin up excitement. And one of the things that we are seeing right now is the Democrats are dispirited, because I think that to a man and woman in the United States Congress, they don't think that he is the strongest candidate. And I think if you were to put them all on a lie detector, you would find out that nearly all of them think that he should step back. They are being diplomatic. I think as Kate said, they are keeping their powder dry. They're thinking, God, if I'm like Mike Quigley and I come out and I call for him to quit and then he wins. And then the next couple of years for Mike Quigley, he's been blackballed. He has got nothing. But so it's politically risky for these people to come out and do that.
Quigley has since come around on that.
Well, he's come around how?
Quigley has called for him to step down.
That's what I said. No, Quigley did. That's why when he did that, he realized he was taking a big political risk. That if Joe Biden does slip through and is reelected, Quigley's in the wilderness, because he was out there saying Biden should
run. Do you really think so? I mean, evidently Quigley thought that too. I mean, what I was referring to, Eric, was that at first he intimated that. He came on my show afterwards and said, oh, I'm still waiting, waiting, waiting. And then he said that he should step down. And having said all of that, if Joe Biden wins, I'm not going to hold that against Mike Quigley. He didn't say that in a vacuum. He was assessing for the country and everybody else what he thought was the best course.
But you're not an egomaniacal politician. They hold grudges for years.
I don't think the electorate would. Go ahead.
Yeah, the electorate won't. Oh, no, not
well,
at all.
Well, he'll survive but, it,
you
then.
Know, I think Biden is still pissed at Barack Obama for endorsing Hillary Clinton, putting Hillary Clinton forward in 2016 him. Yeah. He was the sitting vice president. He got passed over, I think, in his mind. But again, I think that every Democrat knows in their heart that he's not the best guy to take the fight to Trump. How could you argue otherwise? And now it's just a question of tactics. And we can disagree on tactics. I think a lot of people feel like Austin feels like it's just too late for the Democrats to do anything about this, but I disagree with that strongly. I don't think it's at all too late. I think that the excitement, this country would be in an uproar. Everyone would be glued to their various devices and media sources to learn all about this new candidate and the new vice presidential candidate and the debates with Trump. I think there's plenty of time to get the public to make a really interesting decision.
Last thought from Austin and maybe Kate, and then we're going to move on. Go, Austin.
The reason I say it's too late is more because of the two options that are remaining and the fact that the two non-Biden options remaining, which is Kamala or open primary or some sort of like blitz primary has been proposed. Internal party risk with just making it Kamala is that you have every other actor who would want to be in an open primary who doesn't want to have to run against Kamala Harris for the next eight. She'll get two bites of the apple. She'll run this time, and then if she wins, she would be able to run again. So you're putting her above all of these other folks who really want that position. And then in the open primary system, then if Kamala doesn't win, I think you would have a significant problem with Black turnout. The fact that the most prominent Black woman in the country was passed over for that job. And this is really going to be an enthusiasm turnout election. It will be decided on that rather than persuasion. I think people are mostly have their minds made up. So that's the reason I say it's too late. I think practically you could choose another candidate. I think these concerns about ballot access and money are like pretty overblown, but I think like politically it might, the clock may have run out.
It's not too late. It's not too late at all. Procedurally, they can absolutely do it. This whole thing reminds me of one of my favorite jokes where his house is about to be subsumed by a flood. Somebody rolls up in a truck and is like, let me give you a ride. Get you out of here. He's like, no, God's going to help me. I don't need you. Then he's up on his roof with the flood waters rising. Someone comes by in a boat. Come on with us. Nope, I don't need you. God's going to save me. A helicopter comes, throws down a line. He still won't take it. God's going to save me. Then, of course, when he's drowned and he's up in heaven, he's like, God, what happened? I trusted in you. I thought you were going to save me. And God's like, I sent a truck. I sent a boat. I sent a helicopter. Okay. I don't know what the Democrats are crying about. They have every opportunity now. And then they have plenty of time before the actual convention to get this done. If they don't, almost certainly Donald Trump is going to win. So all these people who are so mad that this conversation is happening should be happy it's happening, because this is the only thing that maybe saves you from a Donald Trump second presidency. Look at the Nate Silver model alone. He found originally that Biden had a 29% chance of winning the Electoral College, only 29%. And here's his point. No, I'm sorry. It was
now 29.
It was originally 33.7 and now it's 29.
Got it.
And his point is that even that does not really show the true danger, because the model is built on the assumption of a normal average Democratic candidate. And that is not Joe Biden anymore.
So one thing that is also happening is that the longer we talk about this, the less we talk about Donald Trump's convictions, the Project 2025, the failings or failures of Donald Trump and his campaign.
And that is the Biden White House's fault, as long as they continue this stubborn refusal to admit reality. They are the ones keeping us from getting to the issues. And if he doesn't drop out before the Republican convention, he should really be ashamed of himself.
Of course, we can't blame Trump for 2025, Brandon. He doesn't even know anything about that. He has nothing to do with it. And even though his name is mentioned like 78 times in the document, and it was written by his people.
Exactly.
I know nothing. Says, 109 people were shot over the long 4th of July weekend. 19 died of their wounds. That's how we roll in Chicago in the summer. The violence, which is easily avoided by tourists and suburbanites and even urbanites that don't live on the West and South Side, is still an intractable problem in the short run and controversial in the long. So an architecture firm in the city has come up with a redesign of the Magnificent Mile, particularly the north end of Michigan Avenue around Water Tower Place. And I like some of their ideas, but I told the chief engineer of all of that until people feel it is safer, this isn't a design problem. It's a policy. It's a policing problem. I do like the idea of a long, winding, wide walkway over DuSable Lakeshore Drive to the lake, tiered seating for viewing outdoor events in scattered green spaces doesn't inspire me too much, but I like the effort. One question is, do we need to give up on downtown as a shopping destination? Do we need pop-ups and street-level dining, fewer car lanes and newer bike lanes? Is it a fixable problem, and is this a right fix?
It's a tough correlation. I feel like as far as downtown and its viability, I think there's still plenty of opportunity for downtown to be a viable shopping area. Can it continue to be a place where people can be distracted from their the violence in other parts of the city. I'm not quite sure what the redesign or anything like that would actually do or be related to that. But I do think that my concern would be people still feel like they have access and opportunity in the downtown area, and they're not just confined to their south or west side neighborhoods. That's where I would ultimately, that's what I think would be what I want to see in any sort of strategic plan for downtown. How are you going to make sure that you include the whole entire city in downtown and not just those who are transplants?
I think there's no shortage of examples throughout history where urban design does matter and urban planning does matter for public safety, kind of on a macro level. But I think it would be distracting to think of, you know, facelifts in downtown to be a viable solution for crime. I think as I've said many times, the most important thing to do would to be focusing on improving the quality and constitutionality of policing in the city. We only have 6% of the consent decree completed. And I think every time political leaders are talking about things other than that, they can serve as distractions, and they can also serve as tone deaf. And Mayor Johnson had a bit of like a viral moment in talking about the weekend where he invoked the election of Richard Nixon is somehow relevant to any of this. Yeah. I think the last Republican mayor in the city of Chicago was 1931, maybe. Kate might correct me.
Yeah, just about there.
It's very distracting to be talking about things like this as public safety solutions, in my opinion.
Well, I don't see the redesign as a solution per se, but I think it's a cart and the horse sort of thing. Let's make downtown better or whatever. But if you do that because you want people to come downtown, they're not going to come downtown no matter what unless they feel like it's safe.
Yeah, I do think let's separate the two things for just a second, the redesign and the whether the redesign makes any sense given the crime level. Everything, I'm sure everyone would love to see this huge pedestrian bridge that they envision going across Oak Street and Lakeshore Drive to Oak Street Beach, which is wide enough to be kind of a festival area in itself, is what the Gensler representative was telling you yesterday. It's, to me, it feels a little tone deaf to even think about finding money for something that gigantic. Well, we do have such a crime problem, which is a disinvestment problem, certainly across the city right now. I could see doing the much lower level part of the plan where you're redesigning, say, Jane Byrne Park and things like that, maybe even shutting down one or two lanes of traffic to create the wider sidewalk. But it's true that there isn't a lot of space for kiosks and for areas for people to sit and linger on Michigan Avenue. But are you going to want to linger right now with the crime level the way it is in the city as a whole and also on Michigan Avenue? It makes perfect sense to me that a lot of people who live in the suburbs or else don't come downtown a lot would be skittish about it. I only have to think very vaguely to think of examples. Two people were killed on Michigan Avenue last year alone on beautiful, sunny, busy afternoons, right on Michigan Avenue, one in front of Cartier. And Cartier, by the way, moved inside the Drake for security reasons, obviously. But then there was a smash and grab right over on Oak Street, just off Michigan Avenue. Last year, I had Canadian cousins come visit me, and they were like, why is all of Michigan Avenue got these police SUVs parked up and down the parkway with their lights going? And I had to explain why that was necessary.
You know, they're not there this year, are they? I haven't noticed.
I haven't seen them yet. Yeah. I have not seen them yet.
If you did widen the sidewalk, I like the idea of bike lanes. I like the idea of making it a little more easy to ride your bicycle up and down Michigan Avenue there, but I don't know that there's room for all of that. There aren't a lot of, if you're going up and down Michigan Avenue, places you can just go into and eat or eat outside.
On Clark Street, right?
Yeah.
Clark Street has that. I love the idea of that pedestrian bridge. I thought that architect's rendering of what Oak Street Beach would look like with a pedestrian bridge rather than the tunnel that goes under Lakeshore or DeSavo Lakeshore Drive now. It's a much more inviting and connected feel when you have that there. So, I mean, some of these elements of this redesign seem good, but I don't know that they're going to reduce crime. I think Kate is right to sort of separate those two issues in a way that you can do all the redesigning you want. It's still a policing problem. But to make it more attractive, to make it sort of Millennium Park-like, like you got to go up and see Oak Street Beach, and you got to walk across the bridge, and it's really cool. Those things are important. On the other hand, you know, if we're talking about crime, the investment does have to be in the places where crime is being nurtured, right?
That takes time. I mean, that's part of it. All that takes time. It's not going to happen in one summer. It's not going to happen in one July 4th weekend. And ultimately, July 4th weekend is the most violent weekend across the board, across the country, not just in Chicago. So this is a issue many communities are facing. If you're going to address root causes, as Brandon Johnson says he wants to do, root cause work takes time. And that we may not have the patience for it. If that's what you actually want to do, you got to have some patience there, too.
Yeah, that's why I get frustrated, Brandon, when after the shootings that happened this weekend, the Tribune interviewed somebody whose family member had been shot over the 4th of July weekend, and they said, oh, Brandon Johnson always shows up after the fact and does these sorrowful press conferences. And I thought, what could Brandon Johnson have done to prevent the shootings this weekend? The long-term solutions won't manifest themselves in a week or a year. And I don't think people do have the patience for that. So then we just throw up our hands. And like Eric says, before we did this podcast, we got nothing. We don't seem to have any solutions. Kate's raising her hand. Oh, good. Kate has a solution.
Yeah, I'm going to fix everything right now on this podcast. I don't think that we need to look at as a binary between addressing root causes, disinvestment and lack of jobs versus having policing. These two things need to go together. They have to be done at the same time. The disinvestment is going to take a generation, and people should not have to wait 20 years to sit on their front porch. So although the person you're talking about who said that? Mayor Johnson, how come you're just
here now? She backed off a little bit.
She apologized later. Yeah. She felt bad about it. And he said, that's okay. You don't have to apologize. So he was very good about that. But that's, of course, a lot of people feel that way. And they should not have to wait to be able to sit on their front porch. But I do have to say that Mayor Johnson, though, of course, he ran on a campaign of not replacing, for instance, the 2,000 sworn officers that we are still down. His whole campaign and since then has been, no, we cannot police ourselves our way out of this. We have to do it only through after school programs, jobs programs, other investment. And it's not either or. It needs to be both. Obviously, we need to better the police. We need so much better training. We need to really get with that consent decree, as mm-hmm. Austin is always reminding us. But that actually is important. And I think that came out at the press conference. This was the first time after the July 4th shootings. And actually, another person died today. So that's 20 dead from 4th of July weekend.
Wow.
It was the first time that he, besides talking about disinvestment, also said that it's really important for all the people involved to be held accountable. And Superintendent Snelling specifically said these people have to be taken off the street. Well, how do you do that? You do that with policing.
There wasn't one arrest. There wasn't one arrest. Maybe there's been one arrest. Maybe there's been an arrest since, but the reading I had on Tuesday, I think it was, did you guys catch this as well? Has anybody been arrested and charged with any of those?
No arrests whatsoever.
The Sun-Times says it's two loaded CTA buses of victims, and we don't have a single arrest for those crimes, at least not yet. I'm not talking conviction. I'm talking about an arrest.
That's something where you feel like you do look to the mayor to provide some and so on. I don't know about you guys. The constant refrain of people in Chicago after a violent weekend is not necessarily like surprise, but it's more, and of course, it's always that like constant epilogue of, and no one was arrested. And that gets people so depressed because it feels like there's no accountability for it. I do think that's something that a mayor's job is to provide hope and certainty. And the fact that happened I don't think he provided hope and clear steps forward. And I also don't think he provided people certainty that there would be accountability for the crimes that were done.
Austin, I know you like to compare cities to one another and how they do things. And I've seen stats that Boston has had something like, you know, two murders this year. I think that was maybe a month old or something like that, but they had so few murders. And of course it's smaller than Chicago and all that, but that is a phenomenally low murder rate. And I'm wondering, are there other cities, is Boston or some cities doing things a lot better than Chicago is, or is there something about the way Chicago's gang structure is formed, or the way the neighborhoods are laid out, that gives us the kind of problem that we have here?
Yeah, the city has had three homicides in 2024, I believe,
and that's Boston.
Which is totally bonkers to think about. Of course, Chicago has unique challenges. It has a unique history, has unique gang dynamics. Totally true. But if we look at our peers, New York and LA, we have more homicides than both of those cities combined. Our per capita homicide rate is more than both of those cities combined. And I go back to thinking about Los Angeles, a police department that was completely, it had its reputation in shambles, that wasn't operating effectively, was violating people's rights all the time. This is in the era post Rodney King. And they really were able to turn that department around through governance reform and the consent decree. And I think even you talk to the folks who are sort of most anti-cop, they would recognize that LA does a much better job than most cities in protecting people's civil liberties, while also having better outcomes in terms of clearance rate and things like that. So it's not as sexy to talk about, but that is why I always go back to those sort of basic things.
The Sun-Times ran that story this week about a very low number of gun cases being brought by federal prosecutors in particular. And that mentioned that the ATF says that they have traced 37,657 guns in Chicago over 5 years. We've got more guns here than anywhere except Houston between 2017 and 2021. The federal prosecutors, let's get them to charge more gun crimes, but I think we also have to question what our gun policies are here.
Kate, so, what's the gun law you want changed? I mean, what we're not...
What I'm saying,
we're surrounded by gun crazy states. We're surrounded by gun crazy states.
That's
the problem.
But we can't
control
that. We can't necessarily control what's going on in Indiana and elsewhere. What we can control is, are we going to allow pretextual police stops if the police are trained and doing it well, and then allow them to confiscate the guns that they find? Are we going to maybe crack down on allowing people out pre-trial on electronic monitoring?
I'll also add, when we talk about different cities like Boston and why Chicago is different, I think we have to think about segregation. The cities in America that are the most segregated tend to also be the cities that have the highest rates of crime. A lot of Midwest cities: Detroit, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Milwaukee. And Chicago is a very segregated city, a tale of two cities. We have structurally set people up to where they are stuck in one part of the city, whether it's opportunities, lack of investment, whatever, and that contributes to the crime we see. There's no getting around that. Whereas a place like Boston doesn't have that sort of intrinsic history of segregation and disinvestment in the same way. Here, I'll just add on to this. Yes, there's got to be policing strategy for the now, as well as planning and addressing root causes for the future. One of the big reasons why Brandon Johnson's in hot water with his progressive base is because he's doing that. he is implementing policing strategies. He has increased the police budget when he said he would not. He is adding police jobs when he said he would not. So Brandon Johnson, so far strategically, is trying to walk both paths. Whether that's possible, I think it is. But he's getting flack from both sides because both sides want him to stay on one side.
Yeah, maybe you know you're doing something right if both sides are mad at you. Let me just mention this. Among the groups that coordinated and stormed the Capitol in January of 2021 was the Oath Keepers, a far-right extremist militia. 27 current and former Chicago police officers' names appear on that group's roster. 8 of them are current officers, and 6 of the 8 say, yeah, they signed up for the Oath Keepers. A Department Bureau of Internal Affairs investigation of the officers said membership into organizations in itself is not a rule violation. And this is a quote, "The mere fact that the accused signed up to become a member long before the average citizen and the Office of the Inspector General knew of the group's existence is not enough evidence to suggest the CPD currently employs members of the Oath Keepers." I'm not sure what all that means. It sounds to me like they're I don't know what the interpretation of that is. The city's inspector general says it was not a good investigation, and CPD rules prohibit actions that discredit the department. As we sit here today, the officers are on the payroll, patrolling our streets, and there is no further investigation. Eric, what happened here?
Well, Witzberg's office argued that she said that the Oath Keepers the Inspector General, I'm sorry, got all this notoriety in 2021. And her quote was, you know, that its members have been involved in numerous armed confrontations with government actors throughout the country, dating back to the group's inception in 2009. So it may be that the department didn't know much about the Oath Keepers, and it may be that the Inspector General's office didn't know much about them. They had a lower profile. But I'm guessing that the officers who signed up, the people who put their, you know, their names on the line to join this group, knew about this group. And, you know, I thought you made a very good case that this has been swept under the rug by the department. And I would like to see them reopen it. And they're just saying, no, we're not going to do it. And I think that creates a larger problem of distrust in the department that is, you know, somewhat metastatic.
Is it a union thing that we can't write the rules in a way to preclude groups like Oath Keepers?
Sounds like, too, the fact that you signed a form doesn't mean that you are, quote unquote, actually a member, or maybe violating policy, maybe, you know, discriminating or something like that. I wonder about that, too. If I went online and said, yeah, I'm an Oath Keeper, do I automatically lose my job because of that, or does it have to depend on some action I took as a result of my membership? Austin, what do you think about that?
The rule is that you know, officers can be fired for cause if they're bringing discredit onto the department. And I think what Witzberg was saying was this investigation was really kind of slapdash because they just basically interviewed the officer saying like, hey, what'd you know about the Oath Keepers? And they're like, I didn't know they did all this crazy stuff. And she was like, okay, the investigator said, okay, that's fine. No discipline. And I think what Witzberg is saying, it actually warrants a deeper dive into whether this has brought discredit to the department. So, I think there might be a case for writing the rules in a more clear way. But also, it does seem like this investigation, to the extent you could call it that, was pretty deficient in actually finding out if people had broken the rules in the first place.
Sounds like, you know, you can't be in baseball if you have brought discredit to the game. You can't be on the CPD if you've brought discredit to the CPD. And just saying you're an Oath Keeper is sufficient. Is that what we're asking? If you say you're an Oath Keeper, then you lose your job as a Chicago Police Department officer? And if that's the case, what other organizations? I wonder if it gets gray at some point. What organizations will you allow people to belong to and which will not? That's why I asked a moment ago, is it the actions that they took or is it the mere membership that should cause them to lose their job? It seems to be pretty easy to fire these guys, but I can see how it could become complicated.
Well, what if they were identified as members of a street gang and they say, well, I didn't actually do anything. I was just hanging with my friends and calling myself a member and getting the tattoos or whatever. I mean, that's clearly unacceptable. And it seems to me that membership in an organization like the Oath Keepers is a deal breaker. It's a contract breaker.
How would you describe the Oath Keepers, Eric? What would be the traits of being an Oath Keeper that should make it impossible for you to properly patrol the streets of Chicago?
Well, the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys are both white supremacist groups, and they're both, I think, committed in some ways to violence. And both of those elements, I think, are disqualifying.
John, you said something that piqued my interest, which was that it can't be that hard to fire these guys. It's extremely hard to fire anyone, city of Chicago. And oftentimes, the way that our state government stacks the deck against taxpayers and public officials in this matter is that collective bargaining agreements trump even state law. So if you have a collective bargaining agreement with the police department that says one thing, mm-hmm. you could have every person in city council and every state lawmaker say, no, we're going to have a law that says no Oath Keepers. It wouldn't matter. The collective bargaining agreement, which is not a democratic process, would overrule that. That's often not talked about a lot in police reform, but it's really, really, really important.
Well, what's
that's why I wondered if it was a union thing, kind of akin to the whole controversy going on now about whether or not, you know, really serious police offenses can be public or done instead by a private arbitrator.
Well, who dropped the ball on this, guys? Is there an answer? Is it the union? Is it the Bureau of Internal Affairs? Is it the Inspector General? Is it the mayor?
It seems from Whitburg's report that it was really the Internal Affairs was not equipped to do this sort of investigation. And again, that goes back to governance. Like, Chicago Police Department's Internal Affairs Division is not a good check on the police. And that's been proven time and time and again. A lot of the consent decree is actually related to that. I think it relies the blame relies with Chicago Police Department in some degree here.
The WBEZ Sun-Times story about this did not mention the union at all. So I don't think the union has yet weighed in on this particular issue, or at least hasn't played a strong role in it. Perhaps there are other stories where they do. But I was searching that story for mentions as the union's response, and they seem to be keeping their heads down on this right now.
Their absence is kind of interesting, completely unrelated to that. But I thought the one smart thing that Donald Trump has done in a long time, maybe as a campaigner, he does many smart things. But when this whole Joe Biden story had been rollicking for the last couple weeks, Trump wasn't saying a lot. He was letting Joe Biden and the Democrats shoot themselves in the foot left and right, left and right. And only now has he come out and said just a few things about it. But where you think he would be parading around that, he's smart enough to make it not about his own criticism of them.
Today, I believe that he, not that we didn't know this, he wants Biden to be the candidate.
Yeah.
He knows he can beat him. That's why I was saying it will really be a shame if Joe Biden does not drop out before the Republican convention. That should simply be taken off their plate. Make them talk about their Project 2025 and not
Joe
Biden.
Well, we'll see by next week. I mean, Trump will have to announce his vice president pretty soon. So that might be as soon as next week's episode. We'll know that. But he did yesterday, I believe, to his crowd of supporters in Florida, his big soundbite taking away from that was that he really did want to challenge Joe Biden to a golf match, and Biden's decided not to respond to that just offered sort of a no comment. I will say, in terms of his messaging discipline, that was the thing to say.
It's like when your opponents are busy in a circular firing squad, you just stand back and let them fire away. Yeah. It clearly makes a lot of sense. I'm amazed at Trump's discipline, although he has been tweeting quite, or whatever you say, posting on Truth Social.
Out.
Yeah. Truthing out whatever he's doing on Truth Social. He's not that disciplined. And his speech, his rally was nutty, as every speech he gives is. And I remember that the Democrats were saying that they really felt like when Trump was on trial, it was unfortunate because he wasn't out on the stump. I think it would be good for Biden to stay in the race. And then all of a sudden Biden's out and all their trashing time has been for naught.
Well, last thing from you guys, who's the vice presidential candidate going to be? Is there's maybe down to three? Is it going to be Rubio or Burgum? Or
I'll say J.D. Vance.
All of whom have so completely trashed Trump. Well, two of the three have.
Rubio, I think, is probably has too much time in D.C. for Trump to really trust and put him in that position. It could be a total fool next week if he does that. I would say Burgum is the candidate who gives Trump's goal in this, as we've talked about, is like he doesn't need to be saying anything right now. He should kind of shut up. There's no reason for him to be doing anything. Doug Burgum, I think, gives people the least amount to go after. There's like the least threads to pull, whereas J.D. Vance has a lot of sort of new national conservative, really sort of hot takes that are going to be that, you know, and he talks about those issues in a way that Trump does not. In a way that I think is pretty scary for a lot of independent voters. I don't think Doug Burgum does things like that, or I haven't seen him do that. So I would guess that he would go with someone like Burgum, very low profile.
Even boring.
Well, assuming Mike Pence doesn't want to do it again.
That's a dark horse.
Yeah, I think I kind of lean also towards J.D. Vance, like you, Eric. Yeah, I'm going to go with Vance.
Yeah, I had thought earlier this year that he was going to pick some like Kerry Lake or someone or Nikki Haley, but it looks I haven't those don't seem to be any of those names on his list. Tim Scott is a possibility also, I suppose.
Okay, that wraps it up this week, guys. Nice to see Eric and Austin. Brandon tapped out. Kate is still upstairs in her daughter's bedroom, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, I thought about getting out today, but I'm so comfortable here now.
It works for you. It works for you. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Okay, boys and girls. Thanks for giving us your time.
Nice to see you. That was fun.
Hey, by the way, it does look like we are going to do another remote. We are absolutely on schedule to do another remote, at least one.
Okay.
But one is going to be in the lovely little town of Ottawa because they are now the sponsors of the Mincing Rascals podcast. So they're going to ask us to go out there. It's about 45 minutes west of Joliet off of I-80.
Yeah, it'd be really fun. We could have a sleepover. I mean, this, like I said, it's a huge house.
There's that. We've done a retreat at that Starved in Illinois Policy Retreat at that Starved Rock Convention Center, and there's a bar there that's actually very fun.
Yes, the bar that overlooks the valley or the gulch there. It's fantastic. There's also a new glamping place out that way that's really, really terrific.
Glamping.
Yeah, I've been hearing you talk about it. It sounds pretty cool.
Boutique camping.
Sounds like they're trying to kind of set themselves up like the new Galena.
Yeah, I know. I think they're smart, too. I mean, you know, they don't have the natural resources that Galena does, but they do have two big rivers. They got four state parks. Camp Aramoni. You guys should look that up. Aramoni. Thank you, guys.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. Bye. See you soon.
Bye, Kate. Bye, Austin. Thanks, Eric. Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.